So essentially, to support the growing credit pyramid, the system has to take real wealth from somewhere and basically shift it from things that benefit working people into things that can be profit for the capitalist class. As a result, as everyone knows, since the late 1960s, we've seen a huge reversal of income equality in the U.S. and everywhere else in the advanced capitalist world, not to mention many parts of the third world. I don't want to present a rose-tinted view of the pre-1970 U.S. economy. There was certainly serious income inequality at that time, but it's very interesting that figures show just about 1968, 1970, the wealthiest fifth of the population and the poorest fifth of the population started to move farther and farther apart, to the point that today they're farther apart than they were prior to the 1929 crash, which is the event that sort of ended the last period of crazed capitalist speculation. So there's a real interaction between the maintenance of this circulating fictitious capital and debt and the real material life of society.
I'm speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. So is what you're describing, the deterioration of the economy, society for most of the people, is this a necessary and a direct result of the system of capitalism?
I would say absolutely. Now, to get into the reasons why that's the case, I have to go down, so to speak, another level, or up another level of abstraction. It's very easy, and there are many populist theories of the current situation in the U.S. that can focus on finance, debt pyramids. You just have to look on the internet, and you can find all kinds of people in places like Kansas and Idaho talking about bankers ruling the world and theories that have been around as long as capitalism has been around. But in reality, capitalism is a system in which the financial dimension is quite auxiliary to material production and reproduction. What is truly skewed and unreal about the contemporary world is that more and more it's the maintenance of this credit pyramid that begins to dominate material production and reproduction. So let me explain. At its real bottom level, capitalism is a system in which socially necessary labor time is the sort of fundamental common denominator for economic activity between the working class or individual groups of workers on one hand and capitalist investment on the other. That is, and this, of course, is the theory of Karl Marx, which was a certain important transformation of what is known as classical political economy, developed by figures like Adam Smith and Ricardo, that capitalism, through its activity and increasing of productivity, and even in the last three or four decades, there's been an important increase of productivity in some areas, tends to undermine the actual price paper values of different parts of the economy. Things in theory, get cheaper and cheaper. Machines get cheaper. The cost of doing everything gets cheaper. We just have to think about the computer-connected revolution, so to speak, of the last two or three decades to see a case where the flow of information has expanded exponentially and at the same time the cost of it has gone down radically, to see one example of capitalism cheapening commodities. The problem is that because the bedrock of the system is this relationship between the cost of the social time involved in reproducing labor power, that is, people capable of working and the tools they work with, it tends to make things so cheap that the whole system is thrown into crisis. And what we have been seeing since the 1960s and 70s is a classic case of that. In the late 1960s, I would argue the system got to a point, which it had reached once or twice before, in which this general socially necessary labor time had been reduced by gains in productivity to a point that it could be superseded. In other words, that a new system that no longer depended on socially necessary labor time could replace it. And the most obvious expression of that at that time was a worldwide revolt of the working class against older forms of labor, and most memorably the assembly line. Some people refer to this as the Fordist phase of capitalism, the phase that came in the 1930s and 1940s with huge mass production factories, you know, symbolized above all by the auto industry. And throughout North America and Western Europe, and in some countries of the underdeveloped world, third world, whatever you want to call it, there was from the mid-1960s to 1973, a huge working class revolt of wildcat strikes and organized strikes, and in a few cases, like Spain and Portugal, near revolutions, in which that form of labor was radically called into question. And I would say, and again, we can unpack this further, almost everything that has happened in world capitalism since that time has been a reaction, a counter move. I'm not going to say counter-revolution, because there was ultimately no revolution against the revolt of that period.
Exactly. Now, are you saying then that things get cheaper because of increased productivity, and this increased productivity is an integral part of a capitalist system, and so then the rate of profit falls? Is that how it goes?
Yes. Capitalism is an anarchic system. Capitalism is a system in which hundreds, thousands of individual capitals pursue what they believe to be in their own immediate interest, so that an individual capitalist sees an opportunity to increase his or her profit level by introducing some new technology, and does so, and lo and behold, it works. The problem for the system is that, of course, that example is followed by other capitalists, and the gains in productivity tend to work their way through the whole system. We see, since the 1970s, a transport revolution, both in terms of air transport and shipping, as well as communications innovations that have made it possible to outsource and downsize older forms of production in a way that I think virtually nobody in the 1960s imagined possible. So that, for example, I just read a couple days ago that even distribution centers of goods in the U.S., which were previously thought of as fairly stable forms of employment, now that distribution work can essentially be done in countries like China and pinpointed in its delivery to the place where it's going to be sold. So something that would have been inconceivable prior to this kind of communications revolution and transport. So, and here I'm not even really talking about technology in production itself. I'm simply talking about auxiliary technology of transportation and communication. When we start to look at computer-controlled production and robotics in the production, say, of automobiles or steel, the ability of the system to cheapen goods becomes even greater.
I was going to ask you then, with this natural increase in productivity, which is a part of the system that then makes profits fall off, then are you saying that the problem here, or one of the problems inherent in the system, is that if there's not enough profit generated, then I guess that is why they're outsourcing to other countries. You mentioned the late 60s and early 70s, the wildcat strikes, the problems there, and then countermeasures taken by governments. When exactly was it that jobs started being sent overseas?
Okay. Actually, that does go back to the late 1950s. As the world recovered from World War II, there was a period of 10 or 15 years of quite stringent capital controls, meaning that national economies tended to be very much closed unto themselves, or the governments retained great power to regulate international trade and capital flows. Of course, the U.S. Was in a different situation. The U.S. was funding the recovery of Western Europe and Japan. And it was starting in the late 1950s that U.S. Production began to be outsourced to other countries, starting to Canada, where just over the border, but still with significantly lower wages, attracted U.S. industrial investment. And that process then continued in Western Europe in the early to mid-1960s. But let me get back to another aspect of your question. We have to realize that, you know, when we talk about capitalist development and we talk about things like investment, productivity, all the kinds of things that mainstream economics talk about, we're talking about people in and social relations in production and reproduction. And one of the most significant and understudied, underdiscussed aspects of the 1950s that was connected to a desire by U.S. capitalists to invest abroad was a growing shop floor working class rebellion, which above all expressed itself in the wildcat strikes in industries such as auto in the Midwest. In 1955, Walter Reuther, who was then the head of the United Auto Workers, came back from negotiations with the big three auto companies with a contract with unprecedented wage increases, benefits, et cetera, and so forth, thinking that this would be a great triumph. And the reaction of the auto workers themselves was a wildcat strike throughout the auto industry. And the message of the strike was basically, you can give us all the money you want, all the benefits you want, but what we do 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day is something totally out of our control. And we're going to die of boredom on the assembly line with these higher and higher benefits. And this, of course, somewhat astounded Reuther and the leadership of the UAW, but it showed that something fundamental in the production process was simply being neglected because, as I said, it's not simply a question of these economic factors, but of the ability of working people to have real control over what they do every day. So this process, which began with investments in Canada in the late 50s, continued into Europe starting in the 60s, then went on to the countries in Asia, such as Taiwan and South Korea, which became known later as the Tigers, was part of this general process, a general, on one hand, search for higher profits, and on the other hand, a real concern by capitalists about the growing rebellion of labor in the capitalist heartland, in the U.S. initially, and then starting again in the mid-60s in Europe itself. The important thing to understand about this whole question of productivity, as I said, is the anarchic quality of the system. Individual capitalists do well for themselves by introducing, say, new technology, boosting productivity, and raising their profits. The problem is that because the system is coordinated ultimately by the market, a blind force, what is the advantage for an individual capitalist actually creates tremendous problems for the system as a whole. You can think of it as micro-rationality leading to macro-absurdity. And what that means is that as this productivity ripples through the whole system and cheapens the cost of all goods, it leaves the capitalists confronting two problems. One is that a machine, for example, that they paid for 3 years ago, say $1 million, expecting it to last for 10 years, by these productivity increases, has been depreciated far more rapidly, so that its book value, the value that they have to repay, usually to a bank, is already in excess of what it's actually worth today. And in some sense, we could describe that as a fundamental expression of the contradiction of the system, that the cost today of reproducing something because of these gains in productivity becomes far lower than what the capitalists individually and collectively are showing on their books. So that, and we want to get to the heart of this question of credit creation, the real role of the banking system and the Federal Reserve is to stave off, you know, this fire sale, bargain basement auction of greatly cheapened commodities that we call a depression, the last big one happening in 1929, and a more slow motion version of it happening since the late 60s, early 1970s. In other words, credit creation up to a point when it's supplemented by all these free inputs that I mentioned, both from outside of the system and also in terms of grinding down living standards of working people inside the system, can put off for some time the day of reckoning. But as anyone can see reading the papers today, I think we're getting pretty close to that day of reckoning. Now, from the vantage point of the theory of Karl Marx, which anyone listening to this show can see I'm very strongly influenced by, there's an additional problem, which is what Marxists tend to call the falling rate of profit. And that is very closely related to the phenomenon I was just talking about. That is, on one level, we see this clash between the historical cost of say, a machine versus its current cost of reproduction. That's one problem, and that problem blurs over into this more fundamental problem, which is that over time, the total amount of labor time required to materially reproduce the whole system gets lower and lower, so that at a certain point, and I think, again, we got there in the 1960s, and I think it could be argued that the system even got there sometime around World War I, that in terms of the actual capitalist system as a whole, the ability of the system to regenerate and to have a new period of expansion based on socially necessary labor time fritters away. Marx talked about this both in Capital and in his other book, The Grundrisse, as capital becoming an obstacle to itself, that socially necessary labor time, the time society really requires to provide the basis of material reproduction, people and the tools they work with and the cities they live in or wherever they live, it becomes such a small part of the totally available labor time, that kind of standard, the operation of the market, the operation of what Marx has called the law of value, becomes obsolete. And what we see when the system doesn't transcend itself, isn't transcended in a positive way into another kind of society that would be beyond these kinds of considerations, there's huge retrogression. That is, the system basically, and this is again what we're seeing now and what we've seen for decades, the system has to basically turn back on itself and force things back to a situation in which, from a capitalist point of view, a rate of profit becomes possible. And this is, I think, if what I'm saying is true, I think it's the key to many, if not all, of the important social phenomena that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yes, I see what you mean. The increased productivity should be able to free people. But in order to keep within the system, the economy has to be broken down and destroyed and rebuilt in order to keep the same, in order to not transcend this system.
Exactly. And for those listeners who remember the late 1960s and early 1970s, you may recall a spate of books and articles in the media. I remember a cover of Newsweek or Time or whichever magazine of that kind it was, saying with a cover story, "Can America survive the four-day week?" It was very common, including in New Left circles at that time, to talk about the leisure society and the problems of the leisure society. And at a certain point, at its lowest, the average work week in the U.S. dropped to about 39 hours per week. Now, all of this sounds almost like fantasy land today, where the average work week has increased at least, you know, by official statistics, of which I'm highly dubious, to, you know, 46, 47 hours a week. In other words, about a 20% increase. And much more important, and this probably is the most important single fact, so to speak, of social reproduction I can point to in the U.S., is the way in which a working class family circa 1960 could survive and reproduce itself, so to speak, that is, educate the new generation and engage in the kinds of leisure that were possible at that time, on one paycheck. And as we know, the one paycheck family has more or less gone the way of the dinosaur. Now, let me quickly say that I'm quite aware that the overwhelming majority of those single paychecks were earned by men and mainly by white men. So there was a whole other element of distortion in there. But the fact remains that today, when two and sometimes three paychecks, not to mention the working poor people working two and three jobs, barely hanging on. I mean, there's the famous case, the well-known case of working poor who are homeless and holding down one or two jobs at minimum wage. This is another indicator of exactly this kind of retrogression I was talking about, where the system seemed to be on the threshold of simply going beyond socially necessary labor time in order to create a humane society with goals totally different from capital accumulation. Instead, you get a tremendous retrogression of social conditions, of which we can talk about symptoms till the end of this show, if you want.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the system is being kept afloat presently. And people, of course, have been expecting for decades for the system to go under, but it keeps going. Now we've got this big credit bubble. We've got this U.S. consumer of last resort. We have these subprime mortgages. Now that is unfolding. How do you see things right now and in the near future?
Okay, well, I'm one of those people who's been expecting the whole thing to tank since probably the early 1970s. And basically, you'll often see mainstream coverage of economic matters in the newspapers and other media, a reference to the U.S. consumer-driven world economy. And there is a lot of truth to that, that what has been going on periodically and certainly since the 1970s and the Ronald Reagan era, the 1980s, has been credit creation in the U.S., which has been subsidized by the system I mentioned earlier of foreign countries lending money to the U.S. government to expand credit, give consumer credit to large parts of the U.S. population. Over decades, there's just been an almost constant year-in, year-out increase in the indebtedness of individuals and families. This is subsidized ultimately by these foreign creditors and by the increase of American government debt. It's important to recall that at the time Ronald Reagan came to power in 1980, the total debt accumulated by the U.S. state, going back to its origins, was $1 trillion. And 20 years later, in 2000, it was $4 trillion. So just right there, we can see an enormous increase in federal indebtedness, and that increase from $1 to $4 trillion was made possible by Asian banks, European banks, Middle Eastern oil producers, funneling the dollars they receive for selling goods to the United States back into American capital markets and to the U.S. government debt. That's just another aspect of what we could call the financialization of the system. This is something, again, that I think is probably widely understood by the listeners, that the role of the financial system, this has been part of what has been touted since the 1960s as the shift to a service economy. In the next few years, as people who work in the subprime mortgage field are going to learn, this service economy has mainly been a term to refer to people who are employed in the circulation of this fictitious capital, all kinds of financial advisors and other creators of what are called new financial products, which become more and more complex to the point that today on Wall Street, the typical economic analyst working for Goldman Sachs has a PhD not in economics or econometrics, but in astrophysics or mathematics, because the ultimate architecture, as they call it, of the system has become so complicated that even the CEOs don't understand it. But what it does come down to, when you step back and look at it, is a huge increase of financial assets relative to what we can guardedly call real assets, that is, the things that people actually consume and the things that are needed, you know, to produce those things. So I would say that that process is the main thing that it has kept the system going all this time. That, again, and it's important always to keep this in mind, combined with what I call the free inputs into the system. That is, if the U.S. did not have the ability to tap huge amounts of wealth from abroad, both in the form of immigrant labor, let me just dwell on that for a moment. Immigrant labor has two advantages for American capitalists. One is, of course, it tends to push down general wage levels for all workers in the economy. The second one, and probably more important, is that from the point of view of American capitalists, it comes free to the system. They do not have to pay for the child care and education of such labor power. Those are paid for by the rural societies from which immigrant workers are recruited. And so across the board, in terms of the total wage expenses that the capitalists have to lay out, it's a huge savings. And then, again, as I said, the simple looting of natural resources, non-replacement of resources, non-innovation of technologies that can overcome the depletion of resources such as petroleum, all of these are ways in which the system, in addition to this credit run-up, gets further steam to stagger on a few more years.
We could talk about a foreign war and how that and why that's an integral part of keeping this system going.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And anyone listening to most of what I've said up to now might get the impression that I had a purely economic or economist view of reality. My actual view is that this is all very tied up with politics and with foreign policy and war. The subtitle of Marx's book, Capital, is The Critique of Political Economy. And I insist on that as opposed to any kind of economics as the kinds of realities that I'm discussing. I do not believe, and the history of the 20th century, I think, bears me out in this, that we will see a purely economic crisis. What we're seeing, as I started to say at the beginning of the show, was that there's an element of flight forward by U.S. foreign policy that I see as very integrally tied to these economic problems we've been discussing. And let me just elaborate on that. Even influential, well-known figures like Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski for 20 or 30 years have been talking in their books pretty openly about America as a declining imperial power. The essence of U.S. foreign policy, and let me just at this point plug one very interesting book written by a Frenchman named Emmanuel Todd, came out circa 2000 in France and then was translated into English in 2003 under the title After Empire, which he lays out, you know, something quite similar to what I'm saying, namely that the true aim of U.S. foreign policy in many parts of the world, which in some ways might seem inexplicable, actually is the creation of chaos. That is, when a hegemon, you know, the lone superpower, as the U.S. has been called since 1991, emerges, there tends to be a world realignment of other countries into one coalition against it. This happened famously in the 17th century during the period of Louis XIV in France, where France was such a dominant military power on the European continent that it wound up creating a huge anti-French alliance of virtually every other country. And U.S. foreign policy today, I see as aimed at preventing exactly the same thing. We see Brzezinski, for example, wrote a, in my opinion, very enlightening book in the late 90s. The title was either The Great Chess Game or The Great Chessboard, something like that, in which he outlined five potential rival centers to the U.S. And saying very openly that we've got to recognize that the U.S. is a declining power. And what should we do about this? Well, the best thing we can do is divide our potential enemies and try to negotiate the best possible terms of decline. Well, this is a pretty remarkable statement from somebody who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor in the late 70s. And he said, okay, let's look at the map out there. We've got Europe, we've got Russia, we have China, or East Asia as a whole, China, Korea, Japan, India, and Indonesia, all of them major or rising economic players in the world economy. And Brzezinski specifically points in his book at East Asia as the true main potential rival of the U.S. And what we have to do is find ways to keep them off balance relative to each other. And at the time, it's kind of ironic, he all but said a useful tool in this is Islamic fundamentalism. So maybe we should support the Chechens a little bit in Russia, as we supported the Afghans against the Soviet invasion in the 1980s. Maybe we should stir things up in Kashmir to keep India and Pakistan off balance. And let's maybe support the Aceh Liberation Forces in Indonesia and the Uyghurs in western China. Now, let me quickly point out that Brzezinski was not advocating Islamic revolutions for these parts of the world. He was simply saying that these could be useful tools for tweaking these potential rivals and keeping them busy with other things besides creating a U.S., anti-U.S. world coalition. We can look at U.S. foreign policy very much as an attempt to keep the world from bolting from this dollar-denominated financial system, from creating an independent pole that could rival the United States, and that U.S. foreign policy for the foreseeable future can be read in those terms. And I think whether the Democrats or the Republicans win the 2008 elections, it will change mainly the rhetoric with which those goals are pursued. So I think, you know, what I would like people to come away with above all in this talk is a recognition that what looks like relatively normal business as usual capitalism today is such a distortion of the human potential of the society as a whole, and not just America, but on a world scale, that what is really required is a sort of programmatic imagination that could foresee the end of huge parts of what is currently called work, and the transformation of what is left, socially, truly socially necessary work, into something else that would just create a kind of society based on human needs that would be just almost unrecognizable compared to contemporary reality.
You have mentioned the need for a social slash economic revolution that would benefit most people in this country, perhaps in the world, of course. The government or the owners must realize this as well. Do you see the domestic situation here in the United States as dangerous for political dissidents, for instance?
Well, I think there's no question about that. I mean, what we've seen since 9/11 is just an appetizer, a dress rehearsal for the kind of repression that could be brought to bear on any broader movement that the capitalists would sense as threatening their power. I think if we think back to the late 60s and early 70s, we can see a much wider kind of repression. The apparatus of police red squads and national intelligence agencies involving themselves, infiltrating and trying to influence oppositional politics, the unbelievable, or actually quite believable, changes in the concept of constitutionality that have happened, particularly under the Bush administration. All of this sets the stage for effectively a kind of electronically monitored police state that would make Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia look like libertarian societies. I think the apparatus that's already in place could be tweaked very quickly into something that would be much more intrusive into the lives not just of marginal people or people who are selected out as victims to sort of reinforce social solidarity, but something much more on the scale of the 1919-1920 Palmer Raids, Red Scare, or the post World War II McCarthyite period. So there's no question that as a movement of ordinary working people that would begin to threaten the power of the capitalist class came into existence, that we would see a huge expansion of this kind of repression. But I think compared to what we've seen so far, what we would see in the event of the emergence of a real movement challenging the system at its foundations is, you know, or just it would be in another dimension.
Lauren Goldner, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. Today's show has been Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. Lauren Goldner is author of numerous articles on political economy, including International Liquidity Crisis and Class Struggle, The Dollar Crisis and Us, 1973 Redux, Continuity and Discontinuity in the Decline of Dollar-Centered World Accumulation, two short texts on economic crisis and war, and Fictitious Capital and the Transition Out of Capitalism, among many other essays. His articles have appeared in Against the Current, New Politics, Critique, and Collective Action Notes. He has lived abroad for extended periods in France, Germany, Spain, and Egypt. He has been active in social movements and in important strikes in France in 2003. Currently, he lives in Korea and is writing a short book about the Korean working class. Lauren Goldner's articles are posted at his website, Break Their Haughty Power. For a link to his website, go to gunsandbutter.net.
The interviewer was Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter Radio, produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yaro Mako at gunsandbutter.net. We'll conclude the program with another reading from former teacher John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education. Last week, we began his recounting of the effort to establish an American aristocracy based on Anglo-Saxon bloodlines in response to the wave of immigrant workers arriving in the United States at the end of the 19th century and the role of the new compulsory schools in this class system. Gatto wrote, "In 1896, Latin and Slavic immigration exceeded in body count for the first time the numbers arriving from the ancient lands of the Anglo-Saxons. In certain circles, that was deemed a catastrophe second only to the deluge. This moment had been anticipated for years, of course, and protections for good blood, or the, quote, gene pool, as some preferred to call it, were popping like corn in the form of exclusionary associations you've seen and others like them. This was defensive. But other implements of war were being fashioned, weapons of offensive capability, social engines like modern factory schools, standing armies, social work empires designed to remake incoming aliens into shapes more agreeable to the spirit of the, quote, great race, a term I'll explain in a moment. This machinery was grinding out Americanized Americans by 1913, just 62 years after the Know-Nothing Party of Massachusetts invented the term. New hereditary societies took a leading hand in Americanization. So did important moneyed interests. Chicago financial power got the children's court idea rolling at the beginning of the 20th century, just as Boston railroad, mining, and real estate interests had initiated the compulsion school idea in the 19th. The children's court institution was nationalized rapidly, a most effective intimidation to use against uncooperative immigrants. Such courts soon displayed a valuable second side, supplying children to the childless of the politically better connected sort with few questions asked. The similarity of this transfer function to the historic baby trains of Charles Loring Brace's Children's Aid Society 50 years earlier wasn't lost on the new breed of social engineer graduating from the Wright Colleges in 1900. These new activist graduates, trained in the Chicago School of Sociology and its anthropological variants by Ross Cooley Boas and other seminal figures, had little sentimentality about individual destinies or family sovereignty either. All thought in terms of the collective improvement of society by long-range evolution. In the short run, all were environmental determinists who believed protoplasm was wonderfully malleable, if not entirely empty. In 1898, the DAR, that's the Daughters of the American Revolution, best known of all hereditarian societies, began issuing scientifically designed propaganda lectures on American history and government. By 1904, the Society of Colonial Dames was preparing school curriculum. In the same year, the Sons of the American Revolution distributed millions of pieces of historical interpretation to schools, all paid for by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The Social Register, founded in 1887, quickly became a useful index for the new associational aristocracy, bearing witness to those who could be trusted with the exciting work underway. Tiffany's started a genealogy department in 1875 to catch the first business from elites made edgy by the descent of man, and as the century ended, genealogical reference books, the Gore Roll, Boston's American Armory and Blue Book, and more came tumbling off the assembly line to assist Anglo-Saxons in finding each other. As late as 1929, even with Mein Kampf in bookstalls telling the story of Aryans past and present, David Starr Jordan, president of Stanford, published his own guide to good blood, Your Family Tree. It provided in painstaking detail the descent of America's new industrial aristocracy from monarchs of great Aryan houses. Abe Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, and John D. Rockefeller, said Jordan, came out of the house of Henry I of France. Ulysses S. Grant was in a line from William the Conqueror. Coolidge and Shakespeare descended from Charlemagne. William Howard Taft, J.P. Morgan, and Jordan himself from King David of Scotland. So it went. Was this all just simple amusement, or did the game have some implications for the rest of us not so blue-blooded? Who were these fabulous Aryans the scholars were talking about? What was this great race? The answers were to prove both fabulous and chilling. During the 16th century, a studious Italian merchant living in India pointed out to his wealthy friends some striking similarities between ancient Sanskrit and Italian. Deva, Dio for God, Sarpa, Serpe for snake, etc. All the Sanskrit numbers seem related to the numbers of Italian. What could this mean? This early intuition came and went without much of a stir. Then in 1786, during the early British occupation of India, the subject was addressed anew. In a speech to the Bengal Oriental Society that year, Sir William Jones announced that he believed a family connection existed between Sanskrit and English. It was tantamount to the University of Rome splitting the atom. Sir William declared Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit sprang from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists. Among English and Sanskrit, he showed evidence for a stronger affinity than could possibly have been produced by accident. Close quote. What common source might be the parent of Western civilization? Jones could not say, but only 13 years later, Sharon Turner's 2-volume work, The History of the Anglo-Saxons, claimed to provide clues. There, replete with thousands of illustrations, was a record of Angles, Saxons, Jutes out of ancient Germania, as it had been preserved in song and story, Beowulf raised to a haunting power. Hundreds of cognates between modern English custom and ancient prototypes had been tracked by Turner. There seemed to be a stirring continuity between what Tacitus said about Germania and what upper-class English-American eyes saw when they looked into their modern mirrors. The favorite occupations in antiquity were war, the chase, rough-and-tumble sports, wenching and drinking. Not unlike the preferences of the contemporary Englishmen. When thus not engaged, men often lay idly about, leaving all work for women to do. Gambling was common, and every free man was expected to bear arms. Could the English be the mighty Aryans of prehistory? In 1808, Carl Wilhelm Friedrich von Schlegel, founder and editor of the Athenaeum, chief voice of German Romanticism, wrote a scientific study of Sanskrit which maintained the languages of India, Persia, Greece, Germany, Italy, and England were connected by common descent from an extinct tongue. Schlegel proposed the name Indo-Germanic for the vanished dialect. We are forced, he said, to believe all these widely separate nations are descendants of a single primitive people's influence. Oddly enough, Schlegel learned Sanskrit himself at the hands of Alexander Hamilton, his close friend and a close friend to the Prussian government. Schlegel was highly esteemed both by Hamilton and the Prussia regime. To put yourself in touch with this exciting moment in recent history requires only a visit to a neighborhood library. The languages and customs of this ancient Aryan people are caught in Vedic literature, the story of an invading people who forced themselves on the Indian subcontinent, as Americans had forced themselves on North American natives, a resonant parallel. Aryan literature was exclusively a literature of battle and unyielding hostility. The Vedas, stirring hymns of a people surrounded by strangers, alien in race and religion. There could be no peace with such strangers. Their destruction was a duty owed to God. Full of vigor, The Vedas breathe the attitudes of an invading race bent on conquest, a cultural prescription with which to meet the challenges of modern times. If only a way could be found to link this warrior people with the elites of England and America. In 1816, the brilliant young Danish scholar Rasmus Rask not only accepted the relationship of Germanic, Hellenic, Italic, Baltic, and Indo-Iranian, but went further and found the missing connection. Rask had seen something no one else had noticed. Between some Germanic streams of language and others, a regular sound shift had occurred, transforming the sounds of B, D, and G into those of P, T, and K. It meant an absolute identification could be established between England and ancient Germania. Rask wasn't prominent enough to promote this theory very far, but the man who stole it from him was Jacob Grimm of fairy tale fame. In the second edition of Deutsche Grammatik, published in 1822, Grimm claimed the sound shift discovery, which to this day is called Grimm's Law. Salons on both sides of the Atlantic buzzed with the news. Now the Aryans became the Anglo-Saxons. Endings in Sanskrit, Persian, Greek, Latin, and Germanic showed how these people had moved across the world, said another German researcher, Franz Bopp. By 1820, a Gothic vogue was afoot. Even the bare possibility that some of us were offspring of a powerful race out of prehistory inspired enthusiasm, giving credence to the old Puritan notion of election, that America had a divine destiny as a people. This incredible Aryan drama, like the notion of evolution a few decades later with which it should be seen in collegial relation, almost instantly began to embody itself in more practical affairs of life. To New York State University Regent John O. Sullivan, Grimm's tale was the long-awaited scientific proof of an American destiny, a manifest destiny, as he and innumerable voices that followed it were to call it. Quote, "The right of our manifest destiny is to overspread and to possess the whole of the continent which Providence has given up for the great experiment." Close quote. In 1851, as Moby Dick was coming off the press with its parable of Ahab, a year after the Scarlet Letter had plumbed the secrets of Puritan society, Regent O'Sullivan personally equipped a war vessel for an attack on Cuba. Sullivan's Cleopatra was seized in New York Harbor as she weighed anchor, disgorging several hundred armed Hungarian and German cutthroats, Kossuth sympathizers, as the press mistakenly called them. Indeed, the scheme to, quote, liberate Hungary, nominally under the Hungarian aristocrat Lajos Kossuth, had been hatched by the same zeitgeist and in the same place, New York City. Charged with violating the Neutrality Act of 1818, O'Sullivan beat the rap. Cuba was safe for another 47 years, until the battleship Maine blew up mysteriously in Havana Harbor. Buried in the indestructible heart of this imported Aryan linguistic romance was ample justification for a national charter of bold expansionism. In spite of the fact that much of the American nation was empty still, it provided an inspiration to empire, as O'Sullivan's abortive sortie demonstrated, a racial mandate to enlarge areas of American influence, just as Aryans had once conquered as far as ambition could carry them. Race was the font of our national greatness, but how to preserve the great race from miscegenation? It was a question asked long before Darwin lent the query the authority of official science. As the exciting intelligence from Germany traveled through America, it encountered resistance, for America was a region where class lines were still elastic, based on accomplishment and worldly success, not upon guarantees cemented in blood. Yet the tide was running toward a different form of reckoning. Horace Bushnell, famous Congregationalist pastor of Hartford, where the city park is named for him, thundered from his pulpit in 1837 that noble Anglo-Saxon blood must be preserved against pollution. By 1843, The big book in Unitarian Boston was The Goths in New England. German schooling seemed right for us because we were Germans. Germany held the answers for the grandchildren of Englishmen who had been Germans long ago. In 1848, at the height of the Irish Catholic menace, the American Whig Review published The Anglo-Saxon Race. That same year, the North American Review responded with The Anglo-Saxon Race. Now the Whig Review stirred the pot with its own spoon, the Anglo-Saxons and the Americans. Interest in the topic wouldn't quit, perhaps because the Origin of Species finally placed consideration of racial matters in public attention. Racial fervor was still at white heat in 1875, when a popular book, The Anglo-Saxon Race, Its History, Character, and Destiny, traveled with Chautauqua to every corner of the nation. The writings of William Henry Poole showed the Saxon race to be the lost tribes of Israel. To this day, most American Jews are unaware that a number of old family Anglo-Saxons still consider themselves to be the real Jews, and the nominal Jews imposters. Between 1833 and 1852, Franz Bopp published book after book of his spectacular multi-volume work, Comparative Grammar, which drove any lingering skeptics to cover. The Aryans were real. Case closed. Whatever guardian spirit watches over such things assigned to Sir Henry James Sumner Mayne, English comparative jurist and historian, the task of presenting Aryan tribal character and tying it to contemporary Anglo-Saxons. Mayne graduated from Cambridge in 1844 with a reputation of being the most brilliant classical scholar of all time, Michael Jordan of legal history. His Ancient Law, published in 1861, earned him a world-class reputation in one stroke. In a series of magnificent literary studies which followed, he brought to life the ancient world of Germania with singular felicity and power. Anglo-Saxons and Aryans lived again as one people. In the crucial year which saw Darwin's Descent of Man published, Mayne's spectacular Village Communities in the East and West showed the world the rough-hewn genius of the primitive Anglo-Saxon world. Mayne reiterated his contention that stranger adoption was among the critical discoveries which led to Anglo-Saxon greatness. This message fell on particularly fertile ground in New England, whose soil had been prepared for this exact message by centuries of reading the New England Primer, with its grim warning that children are only loaned to their parents. And what a message Mayne carried. Society thrived when children were detached from their own parents and cultures. It was a potent foundation on which to set the institution of forced schooling. Appearing shortly after the radical Massachusetts adoption law intended to disassemble Irish immigrant families, Mayne silenced the new institution's critics, paving the way for eventual resignation to long-term school incarceration, too. Quote, "The part played by the legal fiction of adoption in the constitution of primitive society and civilization of the race is so important that Sir Henry Sumner Mayne, in his Ancient Law, expresses the opinion that, had it never existed, the primitive groups of mankind could not have coalesced except in terms of absolute superiority on the one side and absolute subjection on the other. With the institution of adoption, however, one people might feign itself as descended from the same stock as the people to whose sacra gentilica it was admitted." From the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition on adoption. In a grand stroke, Sir Henry provided enlightened justification for every form of synthetic parenting social engineers could conduct, including the most important, mass forced schooling. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education on the role of the educational system in the establishment of an American class society. You can find out more about John Taylor Gatto and his work at www.johntaylorgatto.com. And you can download this and previous shows at our website, on welcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening.
The rich will come down.